Welcome to Challenging Colonialism. We have a special episode for you. On November 9th, 2024, the American Indian Resource Center held an event titled, We Will Protect Your Istok, on the UC Santa Cruz campus. Amamutsan Tribal Band Chairman Valentin Lopez opened and closed the event with talks by tribal members Alexi Sagona, Athena Hernandez Esquire, and Dr. Julissa Lopez. We'd like to share the audio from that event, which was part of the Amamutsan Speaker Series.
Well, Nishmin Chuhis, everyone. Kanraka Alexi. I'm a tribal member of the Amamutsan and a sixth-year PhD candidate at UC Berkeley, where I study Indigenous environmental governance and co-management. I'm really excited to... It's great to have so many cousins in the audience. So I'm going to be talking about something that's pretty special to my heart. It's particularly because I became more involved in the Amamutsan tribal band in our community when I was a teenager, 18, young first-year undergraduate student. I reached out to our chairman, Valentin Lopez, and asked how I can get involved. And the Protect Your Istok campaign was sort of gaining traction at that time, and so I was able to, you know, get involved. And about 2 months later, after that phone call, chairman calls me and asks me if I want to go to the UN in New York with him to talk about protecting your stock. And so I was sort of thrown into the fire, but also it was a wonderful opportunity for someone like myself, a young tribal member interested in being involved, to learn advocacy, to learn about, you know, this sort of stuff. Protecting Mother Earth, mainly, is what it comes down to. And what I think is really important to know, to highlight right now is that this isn't just like a reactionary, you know, let's fight against this development and, you know, let's think about why this should not be a mine, right? It's also thinking about an indigenous future, right? Thinking about these visions of what this could be, what this place could become. Thinking about the alliances that can be had between environmentalists and tribal members and other people in the local community, right? I think there's a lot of envisioning here. Yeah, the Your Istok campaign survived through the, you know, pandemic and all those sorts of things where people really had to find something to bring them hope. And I think that brought a lot of hope to us, to me as well, I can say. So I'll be talking a little bit about the campaign, kind of what's at stake, and what's sort of the vision that the tribe has. And then there's some wonderful three other Amamutsan speakers that are going to be following me. So Your Istok, or Her Istok, is at the heart of the ancestral lands of the Amamutsan. It's near Gilroy, California. If you're going Highway 101 south, past Highway 25 or so, you're going to see the Santa Cruz Mountains on your right kind of ending. And then kind of where you hit 129 or Chittenden Pass, that area is the Your Istok area. And here you can see the Pajaro River that's right here, this riparian corridor, which goes right through Your Istok. And so Amamutsan ancestors lived there for thousands of years, gathering medicines, having ceremonies, inviting other indigenous peoples there for different events. And these hills and all these amazing features are very sacred to the Amamutsan. So here it is on a map, if you can see in the yellow, the Your Istok point. So it's not too far from Santa Cruz if you go through Watsonville and head east a little bit. This is another vantage point where you might be able to see the northernmost section of the Monterey Bay, where Santa Cruz is, on the top left. And then more in the center, you can see the Santa Cruz Mountains sort of ending in this area. And so this is where Your Istok is, sort of that area of the Sargent Hills. And so just to get a sense of where we are right now and where Your Istok is. This is where they want to put the mine. The mining pit is supposed to go right in this beautiful section of the Sargent Hills. There's some wonderful wildflowers, riparian corridors. This is another area where it's supposed to go. So just to give you a sense of what this place looks like and what's at stake. Our tribal historian and Amamutsan vice chair, Ed Ketchum, talks about this as a place of power. And when Ed talks with me about what a power place is, it has inherent power. The people chose it to have power, right? So you can't recreate a power place in a sacred site in another place, right? So maybe when folks talk about mitigation, or why can't you just move over here or move the Your Istok area somewhere else? That's not possible. right? The medicines here and the spiritual doctors, they went to Eurostock for a very particular reason, because it is a power place. It's the place of the big head, or the big head dance. And so this is a quote from Kadena Giri, who talks about the Kuksui religion. It's a polytheistic religion. And so many California Indian peoples have this Kuksui religion, and this is where the ceremonies happened, in Mutsun territory. So, you know, talking about keeping the world turning, right? This is what at stake is. These ceremonies, we want to bring these back to maintain balance in the world. And here on the right, you can see some Kuksui regalia that's actually held in a museum in Russia. I want to talk about some of the cultural uses in the 20th century. You know, despite the Amamutsun, you know, surviving the missionization and the other periods of colonization, tribal members continue to use the Eurostock area. And so, you know, this might be with fishing in the Pajaro, harvesting mushrooms, hunting, and rabbit and things like that. And so here pictured is a tribal elder, Nathan Olivas, at the Eurostock property. And he was actually going there, and he was telling me stories about, as a child, his father would take him hunting there and harvesting wild mushrooms in that area. And so, you know, this is still, you know, we might think about this place as being, like, long forgotten and, you know, important for Amamutsun people before colonization. But still, there's tribal members today who have memories of this place, who think of it as an important area for congregating, for harvesting medicines and things like that. This is just a sort of colonial history, right? So what happened? How were Amamutsun people removed? So before the 1760s, it was the Unihaima tribe, which is a tribe of the Mutsun people who lived there. There was about 200 folks who were living in that area. In 1776 was the first expedition that crossed through this Eurostock area. And in 1797 was when the first Mission San Juan Batista was founded, the local mission that brought these Unihaima peoples to the mission. In 1833, the missions were secularized, and the lands were given to Spanish folks, and then later to Americans in 1856. They acquired the land for $4,000. And then after that, it was used as a ranch. It was used for agriculture and also for oil and asphalt seeps. It was sort of mined. And in 1900, the Watsonville Oil Company began operating, and they had produced 780,000 gallons of barrels of oil, which is the largest amount of oil in any oil field in the SF Bay area. So this was also a place of extraction in the 20th century as well. So this place was taken from indigenous peoples, used for agriculture by the Spanish in the Mexican period as well. The Americans came in, practiced their own form of agriculture, kicked native peoples off the lands, and then it was mined. And now it's continuing that same legacy of people trying to profit from this place. Here's an old diseño, a Spanish-era map of the place. It's kind of hard to see, but if you ever want to go to the Bancroft Museum at Berkeley, there's all these old sketches of these historic ranchos. So let's talk about the biodiversity at Eurostock, right? So these are non-human relatives. These are kin for Amamutsun people. We care about this place, not just for ourselves and for our ceremony, but also for our non-human relatives who are also stressed out from, as Chairman was talking about, changes in on the landscape and things like that. And there's a high species diversity here. There's steelhead in the streams. There's burrowing owls habitat. There's American badgers. And so it's just a really important place. So it would destroy 248 acres of habitat that's utilized by the California tiger salamander and the red-legged frog. These are federally listed threatened species. And so these are in danger of going extinct. Another relative I want to talk about is Wasaka, which is condor. So condors, you know, they're at pinnacles. There you see the stars here on the map, Ventana Wilderness. These are the places where they're the most active. But Eurostock is also in their range, right? They can go so far that they can go to the Eurostock area. Other birds of prey that use Eurostock as foraging habitat include the prairie falcon, the golden eagle, the owls. And, you know, the importance of Wasaka is that Wasaka brings prayers to the ancestors, right? They're the only birds that are big enough to fly over the Pacific to the other side to communicate Amamutsun's prayers to our ancestors. There's also burrowing owls there that are present at Eurostock, and they're actually under consideration for listing for the California Endangered Species Act. So just another example of a wonderful non-human relatives that are there that are threatened, right? Their habitats are being threatened right now. Wildlife movement is another thing that's very important. So Eurostock is a critical landscape for a linkage that connects the Diablo, the Gavilan, and the Santa Cruz mountain range. So it's almost like a highway for our non-human relatives, right? And so putting in something that's really noisy, that has a ton of light pollution, that's, you know, physically altering the landscape, that's really bad, that's really difficult for these non-human relatives to get through. And that's important because, you know, genetic inbreeding is an issue, right? So you have to have these populations be able to migrate through to different mountain ranges. Another species that's really important that I like talking about is poker or holly leaf cherry. Now, you know, you might think of California native diet as thinking, consisting of acorn and salmon and things like that. But another, you know, really important food that is less talked about is the holly leaf cherry. Here you can see Kat and myself, we're harvesting some holly leaf cherry in the Eurostock area. And it's a native cherry to California. And what's eaten is actually the pits and the inside. The fruits are kind of small, but there's a quote from a Rumson relative, another Ohlone community member, who talks about how folks would make a hole in the ground and then you roast them overnight, and this would be the way to prepare the holly leaf cherry. So this is just another example of a plant that you don't see too often on the landscape that is present at Eurostock, that Amamutsun people like myself would love to continue learning how to care for this plant and learning how to process it and things like that, right? And so when you're thinking about losing habitat and stuff, it's losing those opportunities for youth and the future generations to be able to engage with holly leaf cherry and things like that. Another plant that, you know, I've been lucky enough to learn how to harvest is the Tina or Tretelea laxa. This is a native geophyte, and it has this beautiful white or purple flower. Here you can see me holding some of the corms, and I roasted them in the oven after that. Unfortunately, I didn't roast them long enough. So it's definitely a trial and error. I'm definitely learning, trying to learn from other folks as well of how to revise these food ways. But it's just another great plant that's at Eurostock that is threatened from this mine. So this mine, right, it would create an open pit in the center of our world. There is natural and cultural resources like I talked about that would cause, you know, that would suffer irreparable harm. And the current landowners, right, this debt acquisition company of America, this LLC, they're an investment company. They just care about their profit. They don't care about these non-human relatives or the rights of Amamutsun or indigenous peoples to be able to practice religion. That's not a concern. And so the Santa Clara County Board of Supervisors are the ones that have the final decision-making say on this. So it's up to them to decide whether or not to approve this permit to create a hole in the ground. So here's just another map, kind of graphic of where it's going to be, the processing plants and the pits and stuff like that. So over a 30-year period, what they're trying to do is directly impact 403 acres of land. They plan to, you know, have a 62-acre processing plant, and 40 million tons of sand and gravel would be scraped out of the earth with heavy machinery. This would be loud. This would be, you know, a ton of light pollution. There'd be trucks all up and down the areas. There'd be more roadkill, other things like that. It would really disrupt this open landscape that's just so special right now. So in conclusion, you know, what I want to say is that, you know, our peoples, we hope to return to Eurostock, this place that has this inherent power that not all places in Mutsun territory have. It's the center of our world. There's a deep cultural history there. There's an ability to reconnect to place, reconnect with our ancestors, reconnect with wonderful wildlife, our non-human kin. And I also say, you know, Amamutsun Land Trust and Amamutsun Tribal Band have been working really hard to revitalize ethnobotanical knowledge, language, land-based stewardship practices. I see Isak right there, who's, you know, really good at indigenous fire and burning, right? Amamutsun tribal members have the capacity now so that when we do return to these lands, we'll be able to care for it, to restore the important qualities, the natural resources and the cultural resources that are there at Eurostock. And so finally, I just want to say, right, land access and our ability to return to this place is really essential for cultural survival and cultural revitalization. So thanks so much for listening, everyone.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Alexi, for that amazing talk. So now we're going to have our next speaker, Athena, come up and talk about some of the legal ramifications.
Nushmin Truhis Khan Rakat, Athena Hernandez. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Athena Hernandez, and I'm the General Counsel for the Alan Lutheran Land Trust. As many of you know, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, and our mission is dedicated to protecting the cultural resources of the Amamutsin Tribal Band, advocating for stewardship and indigenous stewardship, and promoting cultural resources and promoting the education about cultural resources. Like Julissa said, I want to go over some of the legal side of our defense against this proposed mine. So first I want to talk about the environmental review process involved in trying to obtain a conditional use permit. So first, and this happened years ago, the Sargent Ranch Mining Company, who is the applicant of this project, and I'll just refer to them as the applicant, first applied for the permit in 2015. So the process goes, an applicant, submits an application for a permit. The project is deemed a project as defined by CEQA, and the agency does that. The agency here would be Santa Clara County. Sometimes it's not the county, but that's the Santa Clara County is the entity that basically has discretion and controls this entire process. After the project is deemed a CEQA project, and just for those who aren't aware, CEQA is a shorthand for the California Environmental Quality Act. After that point, the agency reaches out to the tribe that's registered on the Native American Heritage Commission list, or the NAC list, and that here was the Amamutsin Tribal Band. And then they reach out to that person in order to consult under AB 52. AB 52 basically says if there is a tribe that is known and registered on the NAC list associated with the land where the project is being proposed, that agency, the lead agency, is required to reach out to that tribe and ask if they'd like to consult. After that, consultation begins. There's really not a designated time frame. It's basically just until consultation is complete. Once that's done, everything that has come out of consultation with regard to tribal cultural resources is then taken into consideration and incorporated into an environmental impact report. Sometimes, that report can be something else that has not as high of a standard as an environmental impact report. But for here, that this project, that was the right project. That was the right mechanism because the project is so complex, so large, and has very devastating potential ramifications for the environment and tribal cultural resources. Once that, typically it's a draft environmental impact report. Once that's prepared, that is, released to the public, and that is, something that's required under CEQA, because for large projects and some smaller projects, it's really important that the public is aware of all of the details involved in the project, all of the impacts, the potential impacts, and that the public's aware of what the agency is going to do about those potential impacts. Also, there's, tribal cultural resources is a big deal, and that's in the report. It doesn't go into detail about the specific tribal cultural resources because oftentimes tribes, and our tribe definitely, considers all of that information in consultation to be confidential. So a lot of times, I wanted to address this because when I started getting into this and I would look at a draft environmental impact report, I wondered why there wasn't so much detail about the tribal cultural resources, and that's why. It's to protect the tribe and the tribe's interests. We basically operate such that we, will share under confidentiality stipulation with the lead agency the tribal cultural resources we've found to be the project has impacted, but we don't let that be released to the public. So oftentimes the findings and the conclusions are there as the agency sees them with regard to cultural resources, but the specifics are not going to be in there in terms of the names of the cultural resources, the reasons they're important, and so on. So that's a really important process here. Once the draft environmental impact report is released, the public has a comment review period. basically the public is able to, the public, that includes organizations, that includes the Attorney General's office, for example, that also includes individual persons. That's a really important process because it allows for, you know, the public basically to have a huge say in whether or not the project should go forward, or more specifically, whether or not things were missed in the environmental impact report, because that report doesn't include anything about the community. That report is created by the agency as the agency understands the impacts, as the agency's consultants have, you know, explained the impacts. So that public review period is really important. It's really crucial, you know, because once comments are submitted, the lead agency has to consider every single comment made by the public and incorporate any new information, you know, include any new concerns that the public raised that the agency has not considered. And oftentimes, and we, you know, this is one of many projects we are consulting on under AB 52, oftentimes we found, maybe not so surprising to everyone here, that lead agencies are just not the best, not sitting at the best position to judge whether, you know, a project is going to impact cultural resources, environmental resources, and so on. Once that, once the agency has included all the comments, read and considered all of them, they might recirculate a draft EIR, but oftentimes that's not the case. That's a little bit more rare. And basically they just go on, they decide whether to certify the EIR, and then that goes to the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission is the one that votes on whether to certify the EIR and whether to approve the project, and the last mechanism you have to challenge that is by appeal. You appeal the Planning Commission's decision to a Board of Supervisors, and they're the ones that make the final decision. After you've exhausted after you've exhausted all administrative remedies, you know, you have appealed to the Board of Supervisors, they have chosen, say, to go forward with the project. That's at that point, you can then bring a lawsuit for, you know, a host of claims under CEQA and or AB 52. So I want to explain a little bit about the AB 52 process. So AB 52 was enacted in 2015. This is a real important piece of legislation for the tribe. Prior to AB 52, the tribe really didn't have any agency or any right to consult. You know, it was basically all in the discretion of the lead agency, whether or not they even wanted to meet with the tribe, whether they wanted to even consider anything, and they weren't required to under law. So our opposition to development projects looks a lot different post AB 52 than it did prior. And it's a good thing. It's a really good thing. It's not a perfect process, but basically what AB 52 requires is a little bit about what I was explaining, you know, prior. It requires a lead agency to reach out to the tribe, to consult with the tribe if the tribe would like to do that. And, you know, after that, consultation ensues, and consultation, and this is a huge benefit to the tribe, has to be government to government. So the agency is the government. They cannot allow any other, you know, outside organizations. They can't allow the project applicant, for example. They can't allow any of their consultants to sit in on those meetings with the tribe. So consultation is confidential, and it's government to government. And the other thing that's really great about AB 52 is that it allows tribes to be uniquely situated such that we are the experts on our cultural resources. So we don't actually have like an uphill battle in terms of, you know, having to justify that something is a cultural resource, like a viewshed, for example. We just say, and we might explain, you know, a little bit about the culture behind it or the reasons behind it, the history, but it does give us a really unique position of being the expert on that cultural resources, as we should be, but it is a huge benefit that the law now says that we are. Once that, you know, consultation process has concluded, it really does, you know, there are, like I said, huge benefits to AB 52. But there, you know, in the end, it really is in the discretion of the agency to, you know, meaningfully take into consideration what the tribe has said and presented and incorporate it in the environmental impact report, you know, in a way that truthfully represents the impacts to cultural resources so that the public can be, you know, on notice. And I say the public meaning like, you know, non-tribal, non-tribal folks who are not in that consultation process. PB 52, I think it's important to note too, while there are, you know, many impacts to other environmental resources, wildlife corridors and such, AB 52 is really strictly about tribal cultural resources. Next, I'd like to talk a little bit about the comments received by the county here. It's actually really amazing. Over 10,000 comments were submitted. That's a historic number. Yeah, it's really great. and of those 10,000, 99.99% opposed the project. That's the most ever for the project in Santa Clara County. And that was, you know, really a result of the efforts led by not just the tribe, and of course, like, tribal youth members were huge in that effort, but definitely our coalition partners. You know, there were many city council members who approved resolutions opposing the project. There were universities, there were organizations like the ACLU. It was really a huge effort, and it really made a difference in terms of, you know, the county is seeing that this is hugely unpopular and, you know, has to go through every single comment before it can move forward in the process. So that was a real advantage for us, that we had the, you know, amazing support from the community and that we weren't sort of alone in those efforts as we often are. Next, I want to go over the significant and unavoidable impacts. You know, Alexi spoke to a lot of the resources that were, you know, going to be impacted here, a lot of the significance of the site. In the environmental impact report, again, you're not going to see very specific things on tribal cultural resources, but what you will see is that, you know, the adverse impacts are on known historical or archaeological resources. There are two known archaeological sites on the project site. There would be damage to subsurface prehistoric and historic archaeological resources and disturbance of human remains, which is deeply disturbing anytime that happens. Lastly, I'll talk a little bit about the current state of the approval process. So the County Planning Commission will hold a public hearing on the final EIR when that's complete. Again, that's been a really long process because they've had to go through over 10,000 comments and consider each one. But we have heard from the county toward the end of 2025 or the beginning of 2026. That should be, the final EIR should be available, unless, you know, again, there's a recirculated EIR or something else happens in the process as a result of those comment letters. So the comment period has long closed. I think it closed in November of 2023. But for, you know, those of you, maybe there are some of you who are just learning about the project, you know, did not get to write a comment letter, everything helps. So if you do want to write a comment letter, I think we've got information on protecturestock.org. There's also information on Santa Clara County's website. And even though they won't be able to legally consider that comment and incorporate it into the final EIR, whatever they you know, propose next, it will still make a difference. And they, you know, will read it. And I do think they would consider it, although it won't be included in that. I think that's basically, you know, the gist of the project and the legal side of things. I do want to say, you know, the legal side of the project can be technical, and it can be, you know, seem a little bit far removed from everything else going on in a project and community organizing and other types of advocacy. But it's really unique working on CEQA claims and opposition to development projects, because all of those are actually very much married and very, you know, they, both of them impact the other. And so it's just been a huge benefit to see the support from the community, and it does impact eventually, you know, maybe what we would incorporate into a legal argument if it did, you know, get to that point. Not exactly there. We still have a lot to see, you know, in terms of how it pans out and how Santa Clara County will address the comments, what next steps we'll take in terms of the final EIR. But you know, it has been very impactful, and like I said, as a last resort, litigation. That would, you know, it the fact that the community has shown up in a big way will, in one way or another, show up in, you know, a lawsuit if that is the mechanism the tribe and the land trust chooses to pursue. Thank you so much. Okay, well, thank you all for joining us again today. It really fills my heart seeing such a full room. I was a previous undergraduate here at UC Santa Cruz, and I was, so exciting. And I was one of the lead interns for the Alma Mutsin Speaker Series when I was here. So I just really want to thank all of the interns and everybody at the AIRC that puts in a lot of work to do this. Okay, so my name is Dr. Jaleesa Lopez. I have to say doctor or my mom will get upset. Okay, so today, and I'm also the UCSC Chancellor's Postdoctoral Fellow, so I'm here on campus in the psychology department, and my door's open for further conversations and to connect to any undergrads that just wanna chat and hang out and be nerds together, because I love to talk about research and I love to try to support people on their path to academia. So I am going to talk to you all about what motivated me to get involved in the Protect Eurostock movement, what actions we have taken as a community, and ways you can get involved. So if we really get down to it, I was truly motivated by spite. I'll just be honest. the reason is because since settlers stepped foot on this continent, they have made an asserted effort to eliminate Native peoples to get access to their lands and extract their natural resources. And our people were subjected to three waves of colonization, and that means that three separate entities saw our elimination because they wanted a piece of this pristine land and access to land that's so rich in natural resources. And for generations, our people have been displaced from our homelands and disconnected from our cultural lifeways. And what that meant is that for generations, the land went without protection. So for many generations, our land has been dominated by industrial agriculture, mining, damming, and other forms of extraction that we've shared with you all today. And Creator chose our people to protect and tend to our homelands, but through colonization and displacement and ongoing intergenerational trauma, our capacity to do so was severely undermined. And for the past three decades, we've been making an asserted effort as a community to fulfill our obligation as the original stewards of the land. And I picked up on something Alexi said, which is now we have the capacity to do so. And that is something that I was reflecting on as well, which is, it's nice that we shared that theme in our talk, is that, you know, that capacity was taken from us. That right to know who we are and where we come from, that was taken from us. And we've been working to restore that. And so us being here today, being able to talk to you all with a huge crowd, it took a lot more than I don't think anyone will actually truly be able to grasp. And we could, you know, tell you how many hours we've driven over here from Fresno, from the Central Valley, from all different parts of California to come to reconnect. And I remember as a youth on those rides across the Pacheco Pass and past Gilroy and always having this sense of longing for this place and always feeling like, okay, it's time to leave. When is it going to be time to go back? And that's honestly one of the reasons why, too, I came here as an undergraduate student, was to finally have that opportunity to build that deeper connection. So I really just want to say that we're in such a special moment in time in our history as Alma Mutsin people that we've never been before. So I really just don't want us to underappreciate that moment. So this obligation to the land was also to ourselves. So by healing the land, we've also been able to heal our people.
Through our advocacy work and reconnecting with our lands, our language, and our lifeways, we're building a collective purpose and identity, and our members are able to feel a pride in who they are and what it means to be Alma Mutsun. As an undergraduate at UCSC, I was motivated to fulfill this obligation as an Alma Mutsun person, and we started a petition to protect your stock. It was actually me and another undergraduate student who was an ally that was like, oh, okay, like, what's the first thing we can do? Like, start a petition on campus, and now it's really grown a lot, as you can see. And while the movement had just started, I actually left to grad school, but since then, so many people have grown the movement to where it is. I literally just started a petition and then left, and everybody has done so much work to get the movement where it is today. So some of the actions we've done is in 2019, we led a 5-mile walk to call for the protection of your stock. Around 100 tribal members and 400 supporters of all ages participating and learning, praying, and working together to stop the proposed mine. Was anybody at that walk? I know we have some tribal members. Nice, awesome, great. And so this walk was very special because we had tribal members who are just a few months old to elders in their 90s that you can see right up in the front were leading the charge. And this walk was also special because it symbolized our returning home. So we started at Mission San Juan Bautista and we ended the walk at Uristock. And that symbolism is really important to us because, like I said, we are in a moment of returning home, of restoring our cultural lifeways, of revitalizing our knowledge. And Uristock holds a lot of that information. It's just waiting for us. So the next year was 2020, and as we know, the pandemic hit our communities really hard. But it's interesting because the pandemic actually brought our Alma Mutsun Tribal Youth Council closer together. We really yearned for each other and, you know, connected virtually to host different meetings on different topics to really help our members get through the pandemic. And we didn't want the movement for Uristock to die. We wanted to keep it going. And so we decided as a youth council that instead of hosting a 500 plus walk, that it'd be safer if just the youth came out and walked that 5-mile walk from Mission San Juan Bautista to Uristock in 2020. And you'll see actually my sister Roxanne on the right of me, and that's where a lot of the imagery for this event has come from. It's actually an illustration of her standing right there. And she's right here in the front. There she is. I've also participated in art builds with my daughters, who are up here, where community artists from Watsonville came to Fresno, and that's where many of our members live, so we were able to get a good amount of people out, as you can see, to create art for our rally in San Jose that you saw in that nice video. And the rally at San Jose was very special. I was not able to attend, but it meant a lot knowing that my niece was there. My sister Roxanne talked at the walk in Uristock in 2019. Over 400 attended the San Jose rally for Uristock in November 2022, marking the end of the DEIR comment period. And the rally was co-sponsored by over 70 local organizations, all of which had representatives in attendance. So these are just some of the efforts that we've taken to fulfill our obligation as the original protectors of the lands. However, we are no longer the only caretakers of this land. Although Creator did not handpick you all to be here like he picked us, you're here now, and so you also share that obligation to tend to the lands that we are on. Regardless of whether someone is indigenous, they also have a relationship to the lands they live on, and they are also responsible for protecting it. And there are so many ways that you can fulfill this obligation through the Protect Uristock movement. With support from allies, we've been able to collect now over 30,000 signatures in support of protecting Uristock, and you can also sign this petition online at protecturistock.org. We've also received letters of support from diverse groups and organizations, and if you are a part of a group or organization, you can also provide a letter of support. And another way you can get involved is by supporting efforts or initiating efforts to pass a resolution. We've received resolutions from various counties and organizations. And another way you can express support is by organizing your own efforts. So local artists have supported us by donating their art to the Protect Deerstalk movement. You can also ask City on a Hill Press to run an article. And another simple thing you can do is to become more educated. We have so many resources on the Protect Deerstalk site. We have curriculum for classrooms, we have classroom assignments, we have PowerPoints, and you can use all of this information to spread awareness. You can also become more educated with the indigenous issues that are home to your home community, wherever you're coming from. So look up the indigenous group in your hometown and support their social movements. I've made a habit of mine whenever I travel somewhere new or visit a new place, the least I can do is to be aware and honor the history of what happened and what the contemporary issues are. And I will tell you, if there is a land issue anywhere, there's going to be an indigenous group there trying to protect the land. So it's really as simple as Googling. And if you'd like to get involved in a more formal capacity or just to learn more, you can also attend the Friends of Deerstalk Tabling Workshop. The Friends of Deerstalk are a volunteer group of amazing allies that help us organize art builds and create public awareness. Now I'll have Chairman Valentin Lopez come up and close us out.
This is intimidating coming up after our members, you know. Wow. You know, they didn't graduate from Barber College like I did. But I want to give a little bit of tribal history of the Amamutsin. It's always best to start our story with our creation story. And our creation story takes place at Mount Umunum. And Mount Umunum was the highest peak in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And it was there that the world was covered with water. And as the water started to recede, that the peak of Mount Umunum became exposed. And there, Creator sent eagle, hawk, probably a peregrine falcon, and hummingbird to the mountaintop to help prepare the world for all that we have today. He had eagle talk to hawk, you know, work with hawk to go down, to dive down into the bottom of the ocean to grab it with his tail on and to bring it to the surface. So all the landforms you saw were brought up by hawk. And then they formed, you know, and then they took a special clay and they molded it into the bees and the rabbits and the squirrels and the deer and the bear. And they made man and woman last. And they gave man and woman a special characteristic, an ability to make decisions, an ability to problem solve, ability to help others, and then a higher intelligence. And with that, they gave our people the responsibility to take care of Mother Earth and all living things within our territory. That gives us a moral authority and a moral responsibility to take care of the lands within our territory. And to take care of Mother Earth, as I said earlier, you know, the people were scientists with that directive from Creator to take care of Mother Earth and all living things. Our people started studying about how to take care of the deer, how to take care of the bear, how to take care of the wildlife, the migrating fish, the migrating geese, etc. And they acquired a lot of knowledge over hundreds, perhaps thousands of generations. And each generation would learn a bit more, pass it to the next generation, and pass it to the next generation. And they learned the prayers, and they learned the songs, and they learned the places of power. And they learned how to use fire as a tool. You know, and a good example is that of other knowledge they learned is just north of here. There's a site that's 7,500 years old, and that site has been continuously occupied. And It's a shell mound. And when you go out there and you study that, and we've done research out there with Berkeley and UC Santa Cruz and other universities, and whenever you look at that site, this, when you look at the shells, they're all the same size. You know, 7,500 years, they've harvested the same size of mussel shell in this case. You don't see large mussel shells, and you don't see the small ones. All you see is mussel shells all the same size. Our ancestors understood the importance of harvesting. You don't take the big ones, because those were, they were very important to ensure future descendants, and that the species carries on. And you don't take the little ones, because you want them to grow to maturity, so they can provide the food resource, or you know, pass on the populations to the future, and such like that. And so that harvesting, how you harvest, that was really important. And that's the kind of indigenous science that I talk about. Our people knew, most importantly, that Mother Earth was sacred. Creator made Mother Earth. How could it not be sacred? And our people understood it was their responsibility to maintain that sacredness. And they did that through a prayer, through ceremony, through making offerings, through reciprocating with the plants. You don't just take a plant, you give a prayer or a blessing, or you offer an offering of tobacco or sage in its place, for you know, to show that reciprocity and the importance of that relationship that we have with them. And talking about relationships that recognize the plants, the wildlife, the rivers, the mountains, the trees, etc. They recognize that as our relative. They have the same father that we did, Father Sky, Creator. They have the same mother we do, Mother Earth, which provides and nourishes us and takes care of all of us in the same manner. And so all these things are our relatives, and we have a responsibility to take care of them as our relative, with love, with patience, with caring, listening to them, singing to them, talking to them. That's the relationship we must have, and we must restore that. And not just the Mutsin people, but all people need to restore the love of those resources and recognize them as a relative. Uristok was our most sacred site. Uristok stands for the place of the Big Head. The Big Head ceremonies were our most important ceremonies. Uristok is also the place of our spiritual leader, Kuksui. And Kuksui also had territories with other tribes throughout California. So Kuksui wasn't Mutsin only, but when it was in our territory, Uristok was his home, and it was there that they led the ceremonies at Uristok, and we'd have prayers for the four directions. We'd have prayers that we could fulfill our obligation to take care of Mother Earth and all living things. We'd have prayers of renewal, prayers for healing, etc. And when the colonizers came, that was the first thing to go, is the prayers for the land and treating it in a sacred way and having a relationship with it. That was immediately taken away. That's what this fight is about. This is what you have joined us and supported us in. And we love you for that. And we'll continue going forward that way. But this is our fight now. We're in this together. One important thing that I wanted to say is you heard about all the letters and the petitions and stuff like that. The Santa Clara County Board of Directors Board of Supervisors, there you go, that didn't sound right. Board of Supervisors, one thing that they did is they created a human rights commission, you know, to ensure the human rights of all people in the county. Well, we went to the I know who that is. We went to the Human Rights Commission, and we talked to them, and we explained about what was happening at Uristok. And they had a hearing, and we had a number of people testify there. And they moved to accept, to state or to declare that what's happening at Eurostock is a human rights issue, and it's a very important human rights issue for the county. And these county and the commissioners were appointed by the boards of supervisors. So it's going to be very hard for the county to deny or to approve that permit when it violates the human rights aspect of importance to indigenous people. A lot of you know that our tribe talks a lot about healing. And we have people here today who we work with and have consulted with and helped in, on healing and have worked together on healing. And we're very grateful for that. But I talked about the, you know, our relationships with the land, the wildlife, and the plants. You know, those relationships were broken. And there's healing required there. You know, the treatment of our native people through the Mexican, through the Spanish and a mission period, through the Mexican period, through the California-American period, where there was great brutality, where there was there was intent and actions to destroy our culture, our spirituality, our indigenous knowledge, our humanity. They wanted to destroy that, and they darn near succeeded in that. You know, after 100 years of not being able to fulfill our obligations and not passing on that knowledge and stuff like that, they nearly destroyed us. Our population decreased by 97-98% during that period of time. And it was very hard growing up. You know, you knew you were indigenous, but you didn't know your prayers, you didn't know your songs, you didn't know your history. And it created a lot of confusion and a lot of difficulty. And you'd have angry outbursts, or you just be upset about things and not understanding it. And it was because of all that was taken from us, the loss of so much. As you heard, whenever they talked about my background, I'm a Native American advisor to the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We deal a lot of that within my family and within our tribe, the issue of mental illness. And a lot of the illness is a result of historic trauma. What has happened to our people over time? How do parents, for that 100 years, how do parents teach their children how to love? How do parents teach them, your children, about, you know, how to look at the world and to recognize their, how they fit in? What is their part of this world? What is their responsibility to this world? How do they have that relationship with this world? That was not given to our people for over 100 years. And we were just left, you know, every day is not about love, not about hope, not about optimism. Every day was just a struggle for survival. And then the ones that didn't figure it out, you know, they grew up with violence, they grew up with confusion, they grew up with addictions. It just makes it so darn hard to know your part in this world. You know, we have tremendous difficulties. This is more in the past than the present day. I'm very happy to say this. But the past was not that long ago, but very high percentages of addiction, of violence, of incarceration, of just outright, you know, just being violent within the family, outside the family. It was just horrible. 1 week I got 4 phone calls from tribal members. 2 of them, they're about to lose their children to adoption. And because of drug addiction. Another person was being sent to a very long prison term for violence, gang activity, and drugs. Another one that was 67 years old. We had a 67-year-old member addicted to meth. And after being married for nearly 50 years, the wife says she had enough and she's leaving. And he called me. Well, she called me and says, "Val, can you talk to him? I'm going to leave him. And before I leave, he wants to talk to a spiritual leader. Can you help him?" And so I talked to him, and we arranged to have a spiritual leader talk to him. They're still married today, and he's clean. And that's been a number of years. But following that, 4 calls that week, I just said, how can we be a successful tribe? How can we develop a path forward? If these are the only issues we're going to deal with, we need to deal with, you know, we need to find a way so that we can go forward in a good, positive, you know, a really good and positive way. And so I got a grant application in the mail for a wellness meeting. I hadn't even heard of a wellness meeting, you know, but I knew for sure that we needed it. And so I filled out that application. And that's what, you know, and from that point forward, we started having bi-monthly wellness meetings. And we deal with hard issues. We dealt with rape. We dealt with child molestation. We dealt with suicide. We dealt with the adoption and the foster care systems. We dealt with grieving. Our people had a very difficult time in grieving. It really had huge impact on grieving. I lost a brother in Vietnam, 1968. From that time forward, my parents stopped parenting. They were in grieving until the time they passed. That was a very difficult time. Those are the things that we talked about at our wellness meetings. And at times, we'd have 120 members at our wellness meetings. But there was a lot of problem solving, a lot of storytelling. We have a psychiatrist work with us. Dr. Donna Schindler, she volunteered her time to work with us. And we have 2 tribal psychologists to work with us. One's a tribal member, the other one is the spouse. And they work with us as well. And what we learned is that the first path to healing is telling the truth. And the second path is telling your story. You know, we need to tell our stories. And we're telling our stories. That's what I'm doing right now. And that's what the healing process is. At one of our wellness meetings, I like to tell this story because it was really important for us. We had a wellness meeting on how to find a mate. How do you like that? How to find a mate. We all needed that, man. Or was it when I needed it, you know? But how to find a mate. And we asked the elders to be there, and then the adults, and then we asked the young ones to come. And boy, did those elders show up. And boy, did they have advice. Don't do this. Don't do that. You know what I did when I was 15? You know what I did in my second marriage? You know what I did? You know, they had stories to tell about how to find a mate. But it was important for our people to listen and to hear that. It was really important for them to hear that. And we thought that we were going to have one meeting, that how to find a mate turned into 3 meetings. That's how important and interesting this topic was, how to find a mate. But in the end, it comes down to, to have a healthy relationship, you need 2 healthy people. You need 2 healthy people. If one person is a liar, if one person is a thief, if one person is a player, that ain't going to work. It is not going to work. And so we had at the wellness meetings, we talked about how do you get yourself healthy? And how do you recognize healthy qualities in others? And then talking about making a list of what you want in your life and not settling for anything worse. Excuse me, anything less. That's the kinds of things we did at our wellness meetings. And it's made a tremendous impact on our in our tribe. The other thing, before our three meetings were up, we talked about relationships, healthy relationships. What about healthy relationships for our tribe and our relationship with the state, with the church, with the cities, the counties, the federal government? I mean, how can we ever have a healthy relationship with them if they're not healthy? If they can't tell the truth about our history, if they can't recognize the way that they sabotaged the treaties that our tribe signed in 1851, if they cannot return the remains of our ancestors that they dug up and now have sitting in museums and universities, and if they have laws in the books that allow the destruction of our sacred sites and our cultural sites, how can we have a healthy relationship? I've written letters to the Pope, I've written letters to the President, I've written letters to the governor, to state senators, etc. I have not got one reply yet. I'd say, let's sit down and let's talk about healing. Not one reply. The only reply, the only interest I got was from a group of nuns. There were four nuns that, you know, during, when we were opposing Junipero Serra's canonization, they showed up. And they said, what can we do to heal? Because we were talking healing then. And they joined us for a couple of our wellness meetings, and they continue their work now within their community. And that's just incredibly important work. One of those nuns is here, Molly. Raise your hand, Molly. She worked with us. And she's working with the communities in Santa Cruz now as well on healing. But we need to find a way forward. We will continue our fight to protect our sacred cultural lands. We will continue our fight to have the truth told. We will continue our work on researching to have to relearn the knowledge that we lost. And we will continue to fight to return to our lands so we can restore traditional stewardship to them and to heal the land and all things. And we ask you to stand with us and be with us. I do want to say that when we talk about the church, you know, about the history, we don't blame you, those that are here, and people that are here today. They weren't the ones that were paying the bounty money, and they're not the ones that was collecting the bounty money. We don't blame you. But we do ask you to please look at yourself and say, how much have you benefited from the theft of our lands, from the taking of the minerals and the resources, and the domination and destruction of our people? How much have you benefited? And what we ask is that you work with us today to help us restore our knowledge and restore our culture and help us return to our lands. Thank you very much.
We urge you to visit the protectyourstock.org website, sign the petition, and support the movement by the Amamutsin Tribal Band to protect their sacred site of Urostock. Stay tuned for more content coming soon from Challenging Colonialism. Thank you for listening.